This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On this program, we're going to talk first with Indiana economist, writer-lecturer Morton Marcus. He'll bring us up today on his Eye on the Pie columns of recent weeks, including one that just came out today. We also have comments for you from yesterday's Veterans Day Armistice Day ceremony that was held at the Korean Veterans Memorial Wall in Crown Point. And we have comments from, among others, Congressman Pete Fisklosky, as, of course, today is the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day. Indiana Gaming Insight, Indiana Legislative Insight Editor Ed Feigenbaum joins us as well, too, from Indianapolis with updates on gaming here in the Hoosier State and Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's start our program today with a conversation with the Indiana economist and writer and lecturer Morton Marcus. He's in Indianapolis. And Morton, as always, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Well, I want to congratulate you, Chris, on maintaining your sanity through the election season.
Yes, I'm kind of just barely holding on, but that's all right. But I think we, all of us who have been going through all this here lately, have done so, and we took advantage of the fact that we had the rest of the week after the Tuesday elections to kind of take a break here, although not completely, because, of course, we had our issues with Porter County up here and had to wait until Friday before we found out how things finally developed in the in that election race there. But that's another story, and it's another local story that's going to continue on going into 2019, I'm sure, too. Usually, I know you typically don't do much on the elections because it doesn't deal necessarily with the economy, but you do have, in fact, the latest column that is out today for readers who do happen to see Eye on the Pie out there will want to take a look at this, and it's entitled, Ready to Live in a Democracy? Tell us why such a statement requires a question mark, and there's a reason why you bring it up.
Well, we have a real problem in the state of Indiana and in many other states where the legislature controls the districting, the drawing of the lines for the various districts, for the Senate and for the House in the state of Indiana. And the legislature basically decides how to maintain the party in power and how to make sure that their favorite legislators don't have any conflicts. This is a very serious matter. And as we come up on the 2020 census, there's going to be new data out there. And the legislature, which not only controls the House and the Senate in Indiana, but it also controls the 9 congressional districts. Well, there are shifts in the population that have been taking place that are well known. The Indianapolis area is growing quite a bit. They're going to get much greater share of the seats that are available. Indiana may even lose a seat. I don't know. I haven't seen the analysis on this yet. But it's possible that because we are one of the slower growing states, states that have been growing faster, such as Texas and Florida in particular, may pick up some seats. Well, they're going to come from the slower-growing states. You don't have to have a decline in population, but just not keeping up as fast as the others. There's a limited number of congressional seats, 435. Indiana has a situation where every single seat, congressional seat in the latest election, was won by 54 or more percent. The average victory was about 61%. Now, these are incredible landslides, and if you look at the actual vote, we have 44% of the vote went to Democrats, and about 55% went to Republicans. There's another small percentage in there for write-in candidates and such, but with 44%, Democrats should have had an opportunity to win 4 of the 9 congressional seats, and Republicans would get 5. That's not what happened. Instead, it's 7-2. 7 Republican seats, 2 Democrat seats. And that's because of the way in which the lines are drawn. Democrats are packed into the first district up there. Congressman Fisklosky was the biggest winner in the state of Indiana. In Indianapolis, Andre Carson, Democrat, was another big winner, because those two districts are packed with Democrats. The rest of the state is drawn up in such a way that Democrats are in the minority. All of those go to Republicans. Now, this is not a statement against the Republican Party. The Democrats have done the same kind of thing in the past. They just weren't in power at the time that the 2010 census results came out. There's a movement in this state to get redistricting, done right, and that is to be much more fair. We basically have nearly a million voters, Democratic voters, who are underrepresented in Indiana's congressional delegation. And it seems to me that this has to be remedied. And there are people all over the state who are demanding that we have a change in the way in which we select, in which we draw the lines. And that can only be done if the legislature itself is willing to give up the power that they currently have. Now, can you imagine that? The legislature giving up its power to retain its own seats? It's almost impossible to believe, but other states have done it. They have developed independent redistricting one way or another. There's some of them that use commissions and other mechanisms. It's just a terrible situation where you can have so many people underrepresented. And I just was incensed when I looked at the results of this election. Normally, I stay away from the election because I'm not in favor of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. There are individuals in each party who I think are marvelous. There are people in each party who I think are despicable. But it's shared between the two parties. My concern is that the people of Indiana are being cheated here.
Well, certainly, you think about too about the money. What money comes back from Washington? Because leaves Indiana, goes to Washington, and we're not getting our share back. And there's got to be some way to remedy that. And I know that redistricting is part of it.
Now, hold on there. That's an argument that has been around for a long time. Yeah. Indiana is not going to get back its quote share.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government spends money for the good of the nation. And we do not have a lot of the things that other states have, which brings more money to them. Just the simplest example, the federal government helps support Indian reservations. We don't have Indian reservations in Indiana. The federal government has military installations. What kind of military installations do we have in Indiana? We don't have a lot of federal employees. Well, federal employees are, the bark you just heard is my dog being upset about this.
And he has every right to be, too.
Oh, yeah. The federal government is basically in Virginia and Maryland and, of course, the District of Columbia. So we're not going to get back our share. That's an idea that politicians use all the time to just make themselves seem more important. And I try to fight that idea as much as I can. We are never going to get back our share. Just think of the federal highways. Montana has a huge space. Lots of highways still going through there. Indiana is a small state physically. Indiana doesn't have national parks with the exception of the dunes. There are very few recreational areas in Indiana that are supported by the federal government. It's just not going to be. And the idea that we're not getting our share is nonsense. It is political chicanery on the part of Indiana politicians.
Now, we know that the folks who are organizing in the Indiana Coalition for Independent Redistricting is going to be keeping a very close eye on this legislative session coming up. I understand they even have a rally coming up here on Organization Day down at the State House, so I'm sure that they're going to be in there and make sure they make plenty of noise, like your compadre there in the home, you know, this, too. Let's talk a little bit, too, with our time we have today, about the one column that came out here that talks about alligators in the statistical swamp. that's an interesting one. It's because it's coming up on a topic that we hate to think about, but we know it's going to happen before the end of the year, and that's income tax return time.
Yep. Yes. We have a situation where many people are looking at data that are really imperfect. But the fact that it's imperfect, and I think I wrote about gross domestic product and how those figures are skewed. But what happens is that the federal government and the state governments who collect data just do not have the money, and they don't have the concepts to make the data as accurate as it could possibly be. They do an excellent job. I'm not faulting them. But let me just take a simple example. GDP has been growing quite rapidly for several decades, and then it slowed down. And one of the reasons that it was growing quite so rapidly was that more and more women were entering the labor market and using the grocery store as a replacement for their kitchen. I'm not blaming the women for doing this. I'm not saying it's wrong. What I'm saying is that what it did is it increased GDP because there were more sales. There were more sales being made by restaurants and by prepared food, and instead of being done in the household. You know, my mother used to peel potatoes. Today, I don't think there are many cooks who are peeling their own potatoes. They're buying pre-made things like frozen French fries and already prepared mashed potatoes and such. And you can just go down the list of all the things that we buy today. As we more and more got people to come into our homes to do things, if this sounds against women, though, let me turn to men. Men used to repair their own cars. Today, cars are built so very few people can repair their own cars. And so we go to the dealer, or we go to Firestone or Goodyear or some other place to have work done on our cars. Well, that's moving out of the household into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And things that are done in the household are not counted in GDP. I don't know about you, but many people mow their lawns. Many other people, and an increasing number of people, hire somebody to mow the lawn. And so now we have an increase in GDP that is, I would say, economic and cultural, but is not indicating real economic growth in the sense of the fact that we now have more lawns being mowed. So that goes along with all kinds of data, including the data that's in the income tax forms and such. The change in the tax laws are going to mean that we're going to have a different view of our economy and the distribution of income, because some things are not going to be weighed as heavily as in the past. So if you say, well, the taxes on dividends are lower, and what you're looking at is the amount of money that the government is collecting on dividends, instead of looking at the level of dividends, you're going to have a different view from what is reality. So these are the kinds of things that I'm concerned about, and I don't know how to change it. I don't know how to repair it.
I tell you, since we have plenty to talk about here. We'll come back again here in the next few weeks here to get caught up on some other topics, too. Some of them also involving Northwest Indiana, too, that I'd like to get your thoughts on as well, too.
Absolutely.
And many thanks to your staff members who are with you there as we speak today.
Yes, the two cats and the two dogs.
That's right. Yeah. Well, they're always there. They all have a purpose, you know, and that's why we enjoy talking with you, Morton. Morton Marcus is a Indiana economist, writer, and lecturer, and he's joining us from his home in Indianapolis. And as always, Morton, thank you for your thoughts and from the Eye on the Pie columns. And there are a lot more out there, too. We'll get back in touch and we'll talk again about those, too. Thanks very much
for
today.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway paid a tribute yesterday to a Korean War veteran from Gary, who was laid to rest back in June, more than 67 years after he went missing in action. 17-year-old U.S. Army Private First Class David Baker went MIA in the Korean War in November of 1950, thought to be captured. And DNA testing and other evidence helped positively identify Baker. He was buried with full military honors in Hobart back in June. Congressman Pete Visosky joined Baker's surviving family yesterday with placing a wreath at the memorial, which is along U.S. 231 southeast of Crown Point. And he told the audience about the efforts to find more missing in action soldiers from past wars.
We're working on a case today for a family that has looked for the remains of an uncle who lost his life during the closing days of the Italian campaign during World War II. We actually think we may have success, but you think about those decade-long uncertainty as to the end result of a loved one.
Congressman Visosky went on to talk about the day itself.
I think the only thing we can do is not only honor them today, but to recognize for veterans that they continue to serve in our communities. Those who are with us today, those who volunteer for Habitat for Humanity, the Legion Post in Gary, who held a fundraiser and event for two young children that were having a very difficult time in that community last year. So again, I think the best way we can proceed and continue to honor them is by giving someone else some time of our life and helping them along. But again, it's a privilege to serve you, and thank you very much.
Yesterday was also an observance of the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day. That's the day that it was the end of hostilities in World War I. Mitch Barloga with the Veterans Memorial Highway Commission added a personal note in the ceremony.
I have a personal connection, and of course, so allow me to brag a little bit, but to talk a little bit about my family in the process. Now, you're at a site that has been dedicated to the honor of veterans and those who have served and died in Korea. And many people are very unfamiliar with the Korean War, and we're very honored that we can bring this lasting tribute to them at this site. However, World War I, although people knew it happened, they really don't know much of what happened. The event took place, as you know, over 100 years ago, and World War II, of course, is very much ingrained in our memories. Of course, many of us didn't live during World War II, but we hear about movies keep coming out about it, and the participants obviously are vivid into our memory. But World War I wasn't nearly the same as that. The World War I was called the Great War at the times, and it was a global war originating in Europe, and it lasted from from July 28, 1914 to this day, November 11, 1918, with the armistice of the German troops. It was actually described at that time as the war to end all wars. It led to the mobilization of more than 70 million military personnel, including 60 million Europeans, making it one of the largest wars in human history. An estimated 9 million combatants and 7 million civilians died as a result of the war. And it's also a considered factor in a number of genocides and the tragic 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, which caused between 50 and 100 million deaths worldwide. In the United States, our troops entered the war in 1917, somewhat at the tail end, and we lost almost 177,000 troops alone in World War I. The losses during this war were exacerbated by new technological and industrial developments and the tactical stalemate caused by the grueling trench warfare that maintained itself through much of the war itself. And as a result of the war, the Russian, German, Austro-Hungarian, and Ottoman empires were replaced by new states based on the nationalities. And the four powers of Britain, France, the U.S., and Italy, they imposed their terms in a series of treaties that were agreed on later on in the following year in the 1919 Paris Peace Conference. Now, if people understand history, a certain gentleman was not very happy about that treaty, and he helped bring the Nazi government to power, and World War II commenced just about 20 years later after World War I finished. For myself personally, a lot of people have family members that serve in war. I have to say that I am very happy that this gentleman is my own grandfather. Morris Roth was a Royal Army Medical Corps personnel. He was born in London and lived there pretty much his entire life until he retired on the seaside. And I'm very blessed because I got to know Maurice very much into my life. In fact, he died when he was 101, and I was about 25 years old. And I know that many people probably have great-grandparents that they probably never knew that fought in World War I, but I'm so blessed to have known Maurice. In fact, here we are kind of sitting on his balcony later in life. I don't know where I got those glasses from, but anyway, there we are. He retired. He retired as a dentist in England on the coast of England in a town called Eastbourne. And my sister, who is here today, we visited many, many times. And again, you're a young person going to Europe a lot. That's not what a lot of young people do. And so it was a real special thing for both of us. But as my days grow older, and my appreciation of what my lineage is all about, and especially what Maurice went through. He was a stretcher bearer in those trenches, in some of the worst fighting during the war. If you ever read about the stretcher bearers, it was not obviously a very pleasant responsibility. Now, the trenches were muddy, they were overflowing with water and stench, and riddled with disease and vermin, and you had then the military on the opposing side lobbing shells over you constantly night and day. And then if you could survive that, there were sharpshooters and snipers also waiting for you. It was truly a barbaric time. And of course, because technology was running ahead of the time, men were being thrown right into basically suicide runs. And my grandfather was in the middle of trying to save those lives as best as he could. One story I'll just leave you with, and the ones that have kind of come down through the time, is when he was in the war, he was on a medical ship at the tail end of it off the coast of Belgium, and trying to service the soldiers that were coming off of there. And he was constantly working, very, very few times off. The soldiers were lying in triage all over the ship, just they're dying all around him. One soldier in particular was not going to make it through the night. And one of the sergeants on the boat came to my grandpa and asked him to walk over and to talk to this gentleman and be with him on his last hours. And during that time, they spoke, and my grandpa was asked by this dying soldier to please find this man's belongings and send him back to his home. Now, if you understand, a lot of men never even were found from World War I. They vaporized. And the ones who did die, their belongings never came back. So this man really wanted to make sure they got back. So they're all in a heap in the ship, and my grandpa went through it when the man died, found his belongings, and sent him home. Little did he know that the parents lived just down the road from his house in London, and when he returned, he was told about it. At first, he didn't want to go, because back then, people had a lot of scams going on, and he didn't want to be part of that. But he was finally asked, please go visit them, and he did. He knocked on their door, he told them he was with their son, when he died, and they immediately were going to give him money. And he's like, I don't want your money. Please, I just want to let you know this was his final words. They were obviously very emotional. And then after the war, my grandfather found out when he was trying to buy his new dentist practice, and the office he was looking at was too expensive, that very family paid for his dental office. And he was there for 40 years in London. And to this day, it is still a dentist office. So stories like that abound in everyone's family. I'm just very blessed that it abounded in mine, and that today, on the armistice of World War I, I can properly tribute my grandfather. And I thank you for at least listening to me at this time.
That's Mitch Barloga, who is with the Veterans Memorial Highway Commission, and his comments made during yesterday's ceremony that was held at the memorial, which is located on U.S. 231 southeast of Crown Point. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn now to Ed Feigenbaum. He's the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight, Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters. They are put out by the Hanna News Service in Indianapolis. And Ed, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me on Veterans Day, Chris. I'm honored to be here, and thank you to all the veterans listening.
Certainly, that's the same coming from me as well. One of the things we want to bring up here is going to the, I guess, the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter first and taking a brief look first at how the makeup with the legislature as it shapes up going into the 2019 session is going to be. What kind of impact, if any, are we going to see in particular on Northwest Indiana casinos?
Well, all the old fuddy-duddies like you and me who are used to the lineup of casinos and the way that the laws have been since 1993 when we authorized casinos aren't going to be the same kind of people that are going to be in the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that are going to comprise the 2019 session of the General Assembly are people who have come in, grown up, basically, under a different kind of construct than you and I and many of the people in Indiana, baby boomers. You know, to them, casino gaming is a normal course of business. It is a normal business entity in the state of Indiana. It has been the public policy of the state for most of their lives now. And they question why we are doing things a certain way, even though you and I may have questions or may not have questions because that's the way we've always done it. We did it this way because this was the market back then. We did it this way because this is how everybody else did it that way. We did it this way because everybody loves playing slot machines. But the realities are changing. The markets are changing. The economy's changing. The demographics of the players are changing. And we need to take a new look at things given all of these different circumstances. And you've got a General Assembly that will be able to do that without a whole lot of fixed constraints given that they were not around when the law passed and that when the law was changed to allow, for example, the open boarding, the dockside gaming. So it's going to be a different generation of legislators taking a new, fresh look at things.
We'll take a look at the General Assembly in general here in just a moment here, but let's take a look at some of these changes. We know that one change is being proposed, at least on the part in the city of Gary, of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. She would like to offer back to the Indiana Gaming Commission the city's second casino license at the time whenever the current casino, the one casino at least, gets to move on land. And I guess the question now is, where's that second casino license from Gary going to go? And we know there are a lot of players that are out there, and we're talking about players in communities rather than the casino players themselves, that would love to have their hands on that license.
Certainly, and let's not get a step ahead of ourselves yet, Chris. You know, there's no certainty that a second license will be available. There are two things that would have to happen in order for that to occur. One is that the legislature would have to approve a change in the site of the Gary casinos right now. And obviously, you know, they're pushing for that land-based site on I-80, 9465. But there are also a number of area casinos that are a little bit less enamored with that prospect, like Horseshoe Casino Hammond and Maristar Casino East Chicago, because they would be competing against a larger and better positioned land-based facility, and this would be off the casino's footprint, so it would require a change in the law. And once you start messing with those kinds of things, all kinds of contingencies can happen. The second thing that would have to happen in order for that second license to be available is that the legislature would have to say, okay, we're only going to allow you to move the one license there. But if you remember from a couple of years ago when Majestic Star was looking at going land-based even within their own footprint, they did not want to relinquish that second license because the tax laws make it very favorable to have two different casinos and have the revenues apportioned between those two casinos. You've got a lower marginal tax rate for that first, $5 million, $10 million, $25 million, $50 million that comes in. So it would have cost them a good bit of money to go from two licenses to just one. If you do have a second license available, then the question becomes, all right, where is the best place to put it? And that's where the new composition of the General Assembly comes into play because you've got all kinds of people who would suddenly be interested in a casino for areas that would not have been interested, you know, 25 years ago. And you've got Terre Haute that's been competing for one. You've got the Indianapolis area that would love to have one, although they're going to have the two racinos theoretically convert to casinos by 2021 when they go to live dealers for table games. You've got other areas, too. You know, for example, New Albany passed on this twice. Clark County, Jeffersonville passed on this twice. But, hey, there's only one casino in the Louisville market right now, so they might be interested in this again. You also have Fort Wayne that's potentially interested. But then again, you know, they were interested a couple of years ago before the Pokagons opened up in South Bend, and now that may be a little bit less lucrative an alternative. And then, of course, you've got the internecine war within Lake County, where Mayor McDermott from Hammond would like a second license, but the casino that he's partnered with, Horseshoe Casino Hammond, would love to see that second license go somewhere down to, you know, Louisville. Well, actually, not to Louisville, because Horseshoe owns that sister casino outside of Louisville in Harrison County. But they'd love to see it go somewhere way far away, maybe Terre Haute. Hobart's interested in getting something now in Portage, which turned things down overwhelmingly in the first round of referenda, literally 25 years ago this month, in November of 1993. All of a sudden, they're interested again, despite, you know, the dysfunctionality that we're seeing within the Porter County and City of Portage government.
Mm-hmm. It's not a done deal by stretch of the imagination, it looks like, because of the fact that we have all these players, or more of these players, that will get involved in this too, I imagine.
Right, and it's not even the legislators from casino areas that would be interested in it. You know, obviously, legislators statewide are going to be looking at this from the same perspective that I think the governor would look at it, and that's, hey, what's the best way to maximize revenue for the state and to spread around some of this wealth? They may not be amenable to the idea of keeping that additional incremental set of dollars in Lake County, and might say, you know, maybe there's a more rural area of the state that would benefit from this. You know, obviously a casino wouldn't go there, but, you know, maybe we can put this in Terre Haute or Indianapolis or Fort Wayne, and then send some of this money to the disadvantaged communities of the state, the Connersvilles, the Richmond's, some of those areas that are seeing some real problems in terms of retaining factories and changing over in terms of demographics and not being able to sustain the kind of standards of living that they had back in the day under the old economy.
And you're also talking, too, in that particular area about the fact that while there are no casinos over in Ohio, you're close enough to southeast Ohio that I guess that you can't draw the money up that way, even bring across the state line very easily, I would imagine. So.
Well, you do have the casinos in Ohio that are competing there. You know, you've got Dayton, you've got Cincinnati, you've got Columbus, and then further away, you've got Cleveland, and you've got racinos in Ohio, which opened up literally since the casinos opened up, and the seven racinos there are bringing in more money each month for the state of Ohio than the four land-based casinos are.
Now let's ask you to take off your Indiana Gaming Insight eye shade and put on your smoke-filled room hat that you wear when you do the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletter. And let's talk. We mentioned her just a moment ago about Mayor McDermott in Hammond, and he has been a perennial thought in the backs of many Democratic Party leaders' minds as to whether he might be the savior of the party. And after this election, and where we saw Senator Donnelly lose to Mike Braun, that's going to be the next question, is how do Democrats in Indiana regroup or even rebuild the party? Is there a possibility that even though Mayor McDermott is staying put in Hammond for now, that he may be asked to help out?
Well, Democrats were certainly in the wilderness, you know, going into that 1988 election. They had just gotten one statewide office in 1986, courtesy of Evan Bias, Secretary of State, but they had hope then. You know, now they don't even have a statewide officer, you know, starting in 2019. And, you know, the highest ranking official, I think, may be the mayor of Pawnee, if the mayor of Pawnee is a Democrat. You just really don't have any kind of roster, much less a bench like the Republicans do. And it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats. You know, obviously, Mayor McDermott is a guy that they might look to. You know, he's won four terms in a city that had a Republican mayor before him, actually, what, two Republican mayors before him. Mm-hmm. He included his dad. And, you know, that's certainly something that they would look to. But there's also the Lake County, what's the best word for it? There's a perception that voters around the state don't want to vote for someone statewide from Lake County. You know, that's just a real difficult perception to shed. And I think that's something that would follow Mayor McDermott as well if he were to look at a statewide office. And I think that he's kind of decided that his best option might be to wait until Congressman Visclosky steps aside. But that may also be a little bit longer now because Representative Visclosky is going to be chairing, you know, a key, perhaps the key subcommittee, the House Committee on Appropriations, the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee.
That's
He's
right.
going to be responsible for the largest discretionary share of the federal budget. And he's probably not going to want to step aside while he's got the ability to influence policy like that. He's also second in line in seniority on the Appropriations Committee. So like Ray Madden, you know, from Northwest Indiana, he could end up being the chair of a real important committee.
Well, who do you think might possibly be considered in the running for helping the party out? And we know we had one candidate from Northwest Indiana, a new guy, I guess, relatively speaking. It was
Jim Harper.
Yeah, from Valparaiso. He lost against his race for Indiana Secretary of State, but you can't count him out.
No, and he's going to be very important in terms of organizing party faithful and trying to do a post-mortem and say, where do we go from here? He's already indicated his interest in doing that, and he's developed a real nice network from his statewide campaign. And, you know, again, the part of the problem is the changing demographics, Chris, and, you know, the way that I look at things, you know, being a guy who's followed things for four decades here pretty closely, the way that I look at things is, well, gosh, you know, Jim Harper hasn't even been elected to any kind of public office yet. But then again, millennials don't necessarily want people who have been part of the problem in the government. They want people who are going to be part of the solution. They don't see the solution necessarily as being part of things that, you know, you and I have become accustomed to over the years as well. So you'll probably see Democrats turn to a younger generation, and you will probably see them look outside of the political world, even though, you know, everybody talks about, well, in the year after we lose, you know, we'll go and look at the municipal elections and build our bench with, you know, nice young mayors, and those will be our futures. Well, the only young mayor that Democrats were able to really elect with any kind of potential for a future is Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
And he's a guy who wants to look beyond Indiana because he thinks that, you know, he'd probably lose a statewide election here quicker than he'd lose a race for vice president of the United States if he picks the right person. So it's very difficult for the Democrats. I think you'll see them probably turn outside of government, and they'll look to the high-tech industry, which is really starting to permeate the state, both the high-tech and advanced manufacturing, and see if they can come up with somebody from one of those sectors that would be a business leader that would be acceptable to, you know, both moderate Republicans, Democrats, and then also the vast number of independents in the state of Indiana as a whole.
I know, too, that we talk here about people like Joe Donnelly, and, of course, before him, you have to talk, of course, about Evan Bayh. Evan Bayh, although he's not likely to be interested any longer, he has two young sons who might very well be up-and-comers in the Democratic Party, too, don't you think?
Right, Birch Bayh, Evan Bayh. Now we've got to wait till Chris and Bo are of age to take office. Yeah, certainly we've seen that having a family surname that loses once, you know, is not going to penalize you in the future. You know, Evan Bayh was elected Secretary of State and governor after his dad had lost his last Senate race. But, you know, we may also be beyond the legacies in the state of Indiana, too. You know, we don't know, but that certainly gives you a leg up. And if you can tap into the family's old network, you know, that's certainly helpful as well. And, we've just got a changing demographic, a lot of people moving in, a lot of people from a generation that don't even remember Evan Bayh, who was literally elected, you know, more than a generation ago the first time. You know, the guy that some people of my generation, you know, I graduated college with Evan Bayh down at IU, and, you know, I remember Evan as a 33-year-old guy just starting, you know, his term as governor. But, you know, the kids today, the new voters today, think of him as this washed-up has-been who lost his last race, and he's a guy in his 60s, and, you know, why is he relevant to me?
Well, it sounds like we'll be looking for new faces in the Indiana Democratic Party as it comes up here, and certainly we'll probably get some of them pop up here as we have the municipal elections next year. Ed Feigenbaum is the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters put out by the Hanna News Service. And as always, Ed, thank you for spending time with us, giving us your words of wisdom, and look forward to talking with you again real soon.
I appreciate the invitation. We'll look forward to it, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase. Over the last year and a half, Soundbites has explored stories of Hoosier invention and innovation. This episode marks the start of the fourth and final season of Soundbites, which will wind down at the end of the Quantum Leap Initiative at the end of 2018. And as we push towards a grand finale, we plan to explore a big, overarching question for the season, and for Soundbites as a whole. What exactly is Hoosier innovation? Is there such a thing? And if so, why? What is it about Hoosiers and the organizations and resources in Indiana have yielded so many ingenious solutions in science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine? Each of these season's episodes will push us to ponder these questions, with an eye towards what it will take for us to sustain this proud legacy. It's a question we hope you'll try to answer along with us. This week, we are headed back to South Bend, Indiana. In previous episodes, we have highlighted some of the incredible scientific achievements that were born from the city's most famous institution, the University of Notre Dame. Today, we move out of the university and into the community of South Bend, a place locals are calling a Rust Belt city on the move. We're highlighting an innovative group of young people that have worked hard to provide the children in their community with skills to personally succeed and hope to make an impact on the world of technology in the process. When Alexandra Liggins was 21, she was in college at Notre Dame studying English and pre-med. While tutoring high school students in the South Bend area, she noticed that many of the students approaching high school graduation looked defeated. They felt that they wouldn't be able to go on to college because of grades or financial reasons. And without the possibility of a college degree, they felt hopeless. Alex, too, felt stuck. What could she do to help solve this problem? After a lot of research and brainstorming, she came up with a solution: computer coding. She learned that there are tons of coding jobs, and you don't need a college degree to get one. You just need to know how to speak a computer language. So she had a solution and just needed to begin to teach South Bend kids how to code. But there was only one problem. Alex had no idea how to code either. So she took immediate steps to learn, enrolling in a community center class on coding. And in that class, she met two other people, Alex Sadenai and Chris Federick, who were there learning coding for the exact same reason, to teach the skill to Hoosier kids with a focus on female students and students of color. This focus on diversifying the tech workforce is a hot-button issue these days. Forbes magazine estimates that in Silicon Valley, more than 76% of jobs are held by men. Only 5% are held by African Americans and Latinos. Forbes magazine writer Anna Johansson notes that it's millennials, people like Alex and her friends, who are pushing for greater diversity in tech. One reason for this push is that developing these skills among low-income communities of color creates pathways for financial success and upward mobility. And a lot of young people want to be part of making the world a better place by increasing this kind of opportunity. But it's even more than that. The question of who builds the algorithms, apps, software, and websites we use every day matters not only because of job prospects. In a world where so much of the information we receive and our perceptions of the world are shaped by tech, having a diversity of life experiences and viewpoints among those who build these tools is paramount. As Johansson notes, the people creating this technology have the power to influence how it works. And that's too big a responsibility for any single demographic to have full control. A lack of diverse ideas and representation could lead to further disparities between gender, race, and class. So back to South Bend. Alex, and Chris founded the South Bend Code School. Today, it's a business that teaches students as young as 7 how to code in computer languages, the basics of computer science, and creative problem solving. Though they operate a for-profit business, they offer scholarships based on income level. They also do community outreach and even work with students in the juvenile justice system. And within the school, children are encouraged to think about problems in their own communities and how they could solve those problems with coding. The results have been wide-ranging, from a community dog finder app to a website that promotes nonviolence and resources for victims in South Bend. Alex and her two partners are not only teaching programming languages. They are showing children that they can solve problems in their community using technology and that their voices and ideas matter. So far, the South Bend Code School has expanded to locations in Goshen and Fort Wayne. Alex hopes that all Hoosier kids will one day have the opportunity to learn to code. The South Bend Code School does not just enable more kids to gain the skills they need for today's job market. The school is affecting change by changing the demographics of those who create websites and apps. With more women and people of color creating websites and problem solving in their communities, our internet will reflect the diversity of our country more and more. Imagine the possibilities. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by JP Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton.
It's time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hi, John.
So we're here to talk about the most popular concert of the year. This time we're doing more than one, and that is our Holiday Pops concert. We have two, and we're doing more than one in as much as we have two venues this year where we're performing these concerts. December the 13th, we'll be at Monbeck Auditorium at Highland High School. And on December the 14th, a Friday, we'll be at Valparaiso High School in their beautiful new auditorium. And we're very happy to have these venues to help us accommodate our vast audience that we have developed over the years, selling out year after year at the Star Plaza Theater for this concert, a single performance of it. But now we are offering more than one performance. So, Kirk, why don't you tell us a little bit about this year's concert?
Thank you, John. Well, the first thing, I would just follow up on your thought in that the Star held about 3,400 people, and we usually would sell 3,200 or 3,300 tickets. So I encourage everybody, please, to like call the office or email us and get a ticket right now, you know, because the concerts will sell out, and we're joyous about that. In answer to your question, John, I'm going to start the concert this year with the Hallelujah Chorus from the Messiah, because we have not done any Messiah for about 4 years, mm-hmm. and people have written to me about it, and it is a fantastic and brilliant and joyous opening to the concert. So traditional things like that. But we're going to do a lot of new pieces this year, not new for holidays, just we haven't done them. Like, I've never done Merry Christmas Baby, you know, and it is a Holiday Pops concert. We're going to do reverent music. We're going to do Ave Maria and See Amid the Winter Snow. But this year we have the fortune to have the Munster High School chorale with us also, for several pieces. And it was something that their director and I spoke about, and the Merry Christmas Baby is going to be so much fun doing it. Really, it'll be just a blast.
We've enjoyed having that group perform with us before for Holiday Pops concerts. They're an award-winning ensemble, are they not?
Yes. And they're also going to be our guest at our Festival of Trees this year, as you know, John. So they're an outstanding group of young people, amazing director. I don't know how much more I can say about them. They're just fantastic. So they're going to join us, and we also have the Hammond Suzuki Strings, because as we all try to do at the symphony, we try to involve young people in our concerts. So they're going to come and play Joy to the World and Jingle Bells with us just for a few pieces. We also have our wonderful soloist that everybody fell in love with last year, Jesse Donner, come to sing. And we have some Mormon Tabernacle choir arrangements that we have gotten our hands on, and he's going to sing them, like the Holy City and Take My Hand, Precious Lord, things like that on the concert.
Are there other new pieces that the orchestra and chorus have never done before?
Oh, yes. There's this Hanukkah Festival Overture. I'm glad you asked me, John, because it is just a blast. It is so much fun. It's full of klezmer music and tambourines and clarinets wailing. It's an absolute blast. And also, there's a piece called On Christmas Day, which we all know, but it's an absolutely new arrangement by the terrific composer Amundsen, who's out of St. Olaf's in Minnesota. And he, St. Olaf's University in Minnesota, and he does terrific arrangements. But there are several pieces like Do You Hear What I Hear, which, again, we all know, but and What Child Is This, which we all know, but they're completely new arrangements that the chorus has never sung, that the orchestra has never sung, and hopefully it just gives us some fresh ears for the concert.
Well, it sounds like it'll be a rousing opening with the Alleluia Chorus. And the whole audience, you can turn around and indicate to the whole audience that they should rise for this. This was a tradition.
We'll have to talk about that. Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's... And of course, John, there is the big sing along, which has been a tradition with us. So they get to turn around and look at their neighbors and sing too.
So they can rise a couple of times during the concert.
Yes.
So there's exercise built into the experience as well. Well, good.
Yes.
Well, that'll be fun to have all that activity going on, and not just one opportunity to hear that concert, but two, one in Lake County, one in Porter County. We're very happy to be performing this concert in Porter County for the very first time ever. So, and we have support from the Porter County Community Foundation to help us with that, as a matter of fact. So, Kirk, thank you for being with us to tell us about this year's Holiday Pops concerts, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and other Eye on the Arts conversations online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and we'll have Eye on the Arts for you again next Monday on Regionally Speaking. That's it for this Monday's Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.